The headlines this hour. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says that Tehran will avenge the recent assassination of a member of the group by the Zionists. Palestinian rights group says that last year's Israeli shelling of a warehouse in Gaza ignited hundreds of tons of chemicals in a northern town. Also in the headlines, the Russian foreign minister says that his country pursues what he calls the liberation of Ukraine's Donbass as an unconditional priority. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says that Israel was behind the recent assassination of an IRGC colonel in Tehran. Major General Hossein Salami said that Iran's adversaries at the White House in Tel Aviv had been following Sayyad Khodai for months and years to kill him. Salami pledged to avenge the assassination of Khodai. The colonel was murdered in eastern Tehran on May 22. He was shot five times by two motorcyclists. A huge crowd attended his funeral procession on Tuesday. Based on U.S. media reports, Israel has informed U.S. officials that it was behind the killing. Israeli footsteps have already been traced to a number of attacks on Iranian nuclear sites and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Political commentator Mustafa Khoshesh explains why Iran has the right to avenge the assassination of the IRGC colonel.
Well, definitely this is going to be responded. Some people might think that how about previous operations? Iran has always vowed to take revenge. And they might have questions if this has happened ever. Well, Iran and Iranian officials, especially the top military, are not in the habit of acknowledging responsibility for operations. And when you hear the Israelis claim responsibility, it's not their officials, but it's their media in order to escape responsibility, because this is a clear case of assassination and terror, and it should be condemned. The Israelis should be condemned for that. And when the UN fails, other countries fail to condemn and punish Israel, then according to the international rules and regulations, Iran has every right to take retaliation.
Iran's president says years of U.S. and NATO military presence in Afghanistan brought the country nothing but devastation.
20 years of NATO and U.S. presence in Afghanistan has had no outcome other than war, bloodshed, and destruction. And the future of Afghanistan must be determined by the people of Afghanistan themselves.
Ibrahim Raisi says that foreigners do not care about the security of the people of Afghanistan and the region. He says the foreign military presence could bring regional security and won't do so in the future either. He made the comments in a joint presser with his Tajik counterpart, Imam Ali Rahman, who was on his first Iranian visit in 9 years. Rahman said that his country shares Iran's concerns about Afghanistan and backs diplomatic efforts for an inclusive Afghan government. He also called for access to southern Iranian port cities as a transportation link for his country. The two presidents oversaw the signing of 15 bilateral agreements, as well as memorandum of understanding, as part of what Rahman called a long-term roadmap for economic cooperation. The agreements cover energy, trade, transportation, and the tourism fields. The Palestinian Rights Group has accused Israel of war crimes over its shelling of a warehouse in Gaza during its attack on the Strip last year. A study by the group Al-Haq says the Israeli shelling ignited hundreds of tons of chemicals in the warehouse in the northern Gaza town of Beit Lahia, even though no fighting was going on nearby. Al-Haq calls the Israeli shelling chemical warfare by indirect means. The report quotes residents as saying that they suffered from diarrhea, vomiting, and intense stomach pains after the attack. Al-Haq says the attack deliberately targeted civilian, economic, and industrial infrastructure in Gaza. The Beit Lahia warehouse is the largest of its kind in the Gaza Strip. Al-Haq is the leading group providing information to the International Criminal Court at The Hague on alleged Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity. Israeli settlers have held their so-called flag march in the occupied city of Al-Quds despite prior warnings by Palestinians who saw the parade as provocative. Thousands of Israeli settlers marched through Al-Quds and its old town while chanting anti-Arab and anti-Muslim slogans. Hamas, along with other notable Palestinian resistance groups, has issued warnings.
Dozens of Palestinians have been injured during clashes with Israeli forces and illegal settlers throughout the occupied West Bank, including East Al-Quds, where Israeli extremists staged a hugely controversial march. This year's march was reportedly partaken by around 25,000 settlers, who were being accompanied and protected by Israeli forces. The settlers were heard chanting Islamophobic and anti-Palestinian slogans such as "Death to Arabs" and "Shireen is dead," referring to veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aghla, who was assassinated by the Israeli military earlier this month. The Israeli settlers forced their way into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, performing religious rituals there. At the same time, Palestinians held counter-rallies across the occupied territories, waving Palestinian flag and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. In Ramallah, the protesters said, although the Al-Quds is occupied by Israel and surrounded by military checkpoints, it will always remain their eternal capital and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always be a Muslim sacred site. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that the so-called flag march in occupied East Al-Quds is a grave provocation against the Palestinian people and the Arab and Islamic nations, stating that the resistance will not hesitate to perform its duty of defending Palestinian sanctities and people. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates has condemned the Israeli settlers' latest raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Old City of Al-Quds, saying the Tel Aviv regime is fanning the flames of religious tensions by allowing such incursions into the holy site. Also, Iran has condemned the Israeli forces' desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and their attacks on Palestinians there. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh warned against Tel Aviv's latest adventurism and provocative moves. He praised Palestinian people's resistance against the regime and recalled the Palestinian cause as the top priority of the Muslim world. He said all freedom-seeking people around the world, especially the people and governments of Muslim countries, have a duty to join hands to wholeheartedly defend Al-Quds and stand up to the apartheid Israeli regime. The spokesman also called on the international community and organizations to fulfill their legal responsibility by stopping Israeli atrocities against Palestinians.
The idea of a national Israeli day is a sign of a group of colonists living in the past. They think they are living a century ago. It is a disgrace in today's world, of course, where we are supposedly past the era of colonialism, rejecting the idea of apartheid. And the responsibility for this, of course, does lie on the colonists themselves, but it also lies on the sponsors of that colony. There would not be an apartheid colony in Palestine today were it not for the fact that many of the NATO states, in particular Britain, France and the USA, are the sponsors of this colonization, this apartheid. The situation would be resolved a long time ago if those NATO sponsors had not been supporting this regime for so long.
The Flag Day march does not hold ground since Israel has occupied Palestine. It is not Israel's land that it captured Al-Quds in the 1967 war and annexed it in a move deemed against international law and rejected by the international community.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, known to Jews as the Temple Mount and located in the occupied Old City of Al-Quds, is a flashpoint. Under a 1967 deal between Israel and Jordan, the compound's custodian, non-Muslim worship is prohibited at the site. In defiance of the agreement, Israel allows settlers to enter the site and carry out religious rituals. Recently, there has been a sheer escalation of atrocities by the Israeli regime against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Outraged by the Israeli aggression, Palestinian resistance groups have intensified their operations throughout the occupied territories. The clashes in Al-Quds had sparked fears of another armed conflict similar to an 11-day war in May last year between Israel and Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas.
But they don't understand really that the resistance that they provoke is the main reason why that regime is going to fall. The first reason that apartheid is going to be dismantled in colonized Palestine is because the resistance has been so persistent, so steadfast and so constant. The second reason is the delegitimization of this apartheid colony internationally. It is repulsing already people around the world. It's even repulsing many Jewish people.
Some around the world could argue it's only a flag parade and nothing more, but For Palestinians, the flag march is one ugly face of Israel's occupation. For Palestinians, Al-Quds is a red line, and they will always defend it with all means possible.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow pursues what he calls the liberation of Ukraine's Donbas as an unconditional priority. Lavrov says other Ukrainian territories should decide on their future on their own. His comments come after Russia intensified its shelling to seize Severodonetsk, which is the largest city under Ukrainian control in Donbas. Russian forces are now trying to encircle the key city. They also destroyed command posts in missile strikes on two towns near Severodonetsk on Sunday. The Russian military earlier said that they captured the nearby city of Lyman, although that account was challenged by Ukrainian officials. Russia is now focused on seizing the entire eastern Ukrainian regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Moscow says it wants to protect the local pro-Russia population there. Reports coming out of Ukraine's flashpoint eastern Donetsk region say that several civilians have been killed and over a dozen injured in the shelling of an area by Ukrainian forces. Local officials accuse Kyiv of using artillery and rockets with cluster munitions. Our correspondent, Johnny Miller, joined us earlier with the details.
I'm standing in the center of Donetsk right now, more particularly in front of what is or used to be a school. Now, this was hit earlier today. Two people were originally confirmed killed. That's been up to three people and five injured. Now, the shelling of the Ukrainian military on the civilian areas of Donetsk is nothing new here. The first story I filed for Press TV when I arrived 2 weeks ago was exactly of that. It's a daily occurrence, and the civilians are killed almost every day here. That usually happens in the outer districts next to the front line. What's new about this account, this attack? Indeed, there was one major attack just after the Russian invasion began of a Tochiku missile fired not far from here, which killed over 20 civilians. But usually Russian air defense is able to stop that. But what's new about this attack here is that it's in the center of town. It's a major strike, a much larger strike than you'd normally see in the outskirts in districts like Petrovsky. Interestingly also, I asked people around here whether they think this school was targeted. They said, well, what do you think? Why? Because none of the other buildings are damaged. And this strike is right in the center, on the doorstep, if you like, of this building. It's a large building, a symmetrical building. The strike is right in the middle. There's also reports of another school nearby here, which I'll be investigating after this interview to see if that's been hit as well. Now, interestingly, I've spoken to the Donetsk People's Republic and asked them why now the Ukrainians are able to shell the center of Donetsk. They say it's because up till now they've only had artillery that can reach the districts next to the front line. But they are now blaming NATO and particularly the Americans because they think that it was an American heavy long-range artillery piece that's now able to reach the center of Donetsk.
An embargo on Russian oil over its war in Ukraine remains the main sticking point as EU leaders arrive in Brussels for a summit. Some leaders, including the European Commission president, says that the new anti-Russia measure lacks consensus.
We do have today one topic that is still open, that is the sixth sanctions package. We've been working very hard and successful with five sanction packages already. It's never been easy. It's the same now with the sixth package. The Commission and the French presidency have been working intensively in the last days to move forward on this package. We are not there yet, but it has matured for sure.
Talking to reporters upon her arrival, Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas said it was more realistic to expect an agreement in the next summit. Remarks came as senior EU diplomats are still deadlocked. Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic have already expressed their opposition, arguing that an oil embargo would be a severe blow to their economies. However, a compromise plan has been discussed ahead of Monday's summit. According to a new draft, landlocked Central European countries would be given an exemption for pipeline deliveries of Russian gas. But the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said things are not looking good on any compromise plan for an oil embargo. Italy's two-time Prime Minister Romano Prodi has expressed serious concerns over the consequences that are associated with the Ukraine-Russia conflict. He has warned the sanctions against Moscow would cost a lot, mainly to Italy, Germany, and the EU.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome, known for having overseen an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation. Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period.
I have said many times that the impact of the sanctions against Russia will be completely asymmetrical. It goes without saying that the consequences on some countries like France or Spain will be milder.
Earlier this week, Moscow dismissed a plan for peace in Ukraine proposed by Italy. Also, Hungary has urged Brussels to call explicitly for a ceasefire in Ukraine. However, so far, some members of the bloc and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have adopted a hawkish posture on Russia, never making any mention of peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh my God, all buildings have collapsed. Watching stuff like war and bloodshed makes me nervous. I better turn off the television. Nothing's more horrible than war, and of course, peace is one of the most beautiful words ever created. By the way, did you know that we have a Museum of Peace in Tehran? Taking a tour to this museum would be a good idea for today. Yes, why not? Stay with me. The idea of founding Tehran Peace Museum took shape following talks between the founders of the Tehran-based Society for Chemical Weapons Victims Support, SCWVS, and a coordinator for the International Network of Museums for Peace in 2005. The founders of Tehran's Peace Museum came to the conclusion that the suffering of Iranian people, which were caused by the enemy's chemical weapons, is a good reason for exhibiting the consequences of war and violence. Tehran Peace Museum was temporarily closed for public visitors in 2010 for redesign, and the new building with a completely new design was inaugurated in a ceremony in June 2011, attended by guests from different countries, including director of Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum. Tehran Peace Museum has several features, such as it is the member of the International Network of Peace Museums. Its active members, particularly the museum guides, are the victims of war and chemical weapons. Tehran Peace Museum is linked to other peace museums around the world. Tehran Peace Museum pursues the goal of promoting the culture of peace. I am now in front of the entrance gate of Tehran Peace Museum, which is located at Park Shahr. Just beside me, there is a statue of a dove that is drinking water from inside a combat helmet. You know, dove is the symbol of peace, and this statue beautifully shows the significance of peace. Next to this statue, there is another statue which has the shape of the word sol, literally peace, with the beautiful Nastaliq-style calligraphy, and just above it, a dove flying. The color of this artistic craft is white, reminiscent of peace and calm and tranquility. So, let's go inside the museum to see what's exactly there.
in a big hall. In this hall, there are the busts of the world-famous people who have done something for peace. There is a writing explaining everyone's life and efforts just beside each of the busts. This is the bust of Henri Dunant, founder of the International Red Cross. Just beside this bust, we have the bust of Mahatma Gandhi. And here, there is a television which shows a movie about the first charter of human rights in the world, namely the Cyrus Charter. And just below the television, there is a version of the clay cylinder of the Cyrus Charter on which is written a declaration in cuneiform script. Oh, look at here. The bust of Adolf Hitler. You know, Tehran Peace Museum also reminds us of those who jeopardized world peace and security and caused human suffering. Hitler is one of those savages. Oh my God. In this part of the museum, there is the statue of Zahak, the snake shoulder. According to Iranian mythology, Zahak was an oppressor who was bound into the walls of a cavern on Mount Damavand by a person called Fereydun. This statue also represents Zahak being tied. Of course, we cannot discuss the spectacles of this museum in a brief radio program. But if you happen to take a trip to Tehran, make sure to visit this museum. The online display of this museum is also available for enthusiasts.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Economic divide.
The future of the world is at risk due to climate change. All scientific data points to that. In this part of the world, West Asia, the situation is in a crisis mode due to lack of water. Add to that Turkey's many dam constructions, and that is a recipe for possible conflict with economic ramifications. Hi, I'm Kaveh Taflayi. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, West Asia climate crisis. Lack of water is a result of that, threatening the regional economies. Obviously, climate change has contributed to a major portion of that. But there are other factors involved. We're going to take a look at Turkey's dam projects. What has it done? It has altered the flow of the rivers like Tigris and the Euphrates. The impact on countries like Iran, Syria, and Iraq. That adds to risk of regional tensions. However, Turkey looks at the situation in another way. It has a claim, according to how it sees it. It has a right to its water resources, and it's comparing its water to Arab countries' oil. Is it suggesting a swap? In recent weeks, severe dust storms have disrupted daily lives in many countries in the West Asia region, including Iran, Iraq, and some Persian Gulf Arab states. The emergency situation in the region is part of the larger climate change crisis that is affecting different parts of the globe. The impacts could increase drought conditions, aridity, heat waves, and sea level rises. The severe weather conditions in the West Asia could seriously hamper the capabilities of the countries in the region to produce enough food. Decreases in food production and increases in grain prices could destabilize the already volatile region. Climate crisis was part of the reason why a war began on Syria in the year 2011. But apart from climate factors, man-made developments are also major factors in high levels of aridity and drought in the region. Turkey has been playing an unconstructive role in the current crisis. Critics say that it is restricting water supplies to Iran, Syria, and Iraq through dam building. The Euphrates-Tigris Basin is shared between Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. Iran also comprises parts of the Tigris Basin. Approximately 90% of the water flow in the Euphrates and 50% in the Tigris originate in Turkey. Recent political tensions in the region and the emergence of terrorist outfits have hampered collective efforts to tackle the crisis. The World Bank has warned that Iraq could potentially suffer a 20% drop in water resources by the year 2050. However, Turkey's massive dam projects have contributed to rising levels of drought in the region. Since the 1960s, unilateral irrigation plans, altering the flows of the rivers, coupled with political tensions between the countries, have strained relations in the basin. When it comes to water resources, scientists have time and again warned not only about shortages that exist in many parts of the world, especially due to climate change, but also of the tensions that this would cause between countries who are vying for possession of the precious commodity. Now, this has given rise to the term water wars. Well, in West Asia, this is a matter of great concern, as evident in some of the online posts. Taking a look at our first post, Middle East and North Africa is the most water-scarce region in the world. Nearly two-thirds of the population are living in areas that lack sufficient renewable water resources to sustain current levels of activity and growth. Our next post, Iraq dust storm, flights grounded in Baghdad and Najaf. As skies turn orange, dust storms have become increasingly common in the Middle East, experts blaming a combination of climate change and mismanagement of land and water, a lack of green areas. So that's how bad this area in West Asia is doing. Next up, Turkey. This tweet says Turkey has designed their dams so they can restrict water to Syria and to Iraq in order to make them more amenable to Turkish demands. Their officials have confirmed it. This is a continuation of this policy. And expanding further on Turkey's ambitions, the next post, Turkey is building dams to control and restrict the flow of water to northeast Syria. Now, digging deeper into this, Turkey proxies weaponizing water in northern Syria based on a report that has said Turkish-backed groups in northern Syria have weaponized water by building dams on a river that serves as a lifeline for communities living downstream in Kurdish-dominated areas. So a political motive there for Turkey. Then it goes on to say the SNA, or the Syrian National Army's blocking of a vital river during the region's driest summer on record, was a clear-cut example of using water as weapons of war. And finally, it goes to say the Khabur is a 320-kilometer long, or 200 miles, tributary of the Euphrates, whose source is in Turkey, but runs across much of northeastern Syria and through Hasaka. All right, so there you have some of the tweets, which, by the way, are pretty informative from the people who are writing it. Let me introduce our guest for this section of the program. We have Ashok Swain joining us. He's a professor of peace and conflict research at Uppsala University. And he's also the UNESCO chair on international water cooperation, who joins us from Uppsala. All right, very good. Ashok Swain, welcome. The falling levels of the
Tigris and Euphrates that you're well aware of. It warns of an impending water crisis. Countries like Syria and Iraq first, and then Iran also to suffer from this. And all three have actually accused Turkey of using its many dams that it has constructed, 22 on record, hoarding water along the Euphrates and the Tigris. How do you see this in terms of Turkey's ambitions here? Is Turkey guilty of hoarding the water and using it for political gains?
Turkey controls the upstream of Euphrates and Tigris River, and these two rivers are the main water supplier, at least to Syria and Iraq. The Turkey contributes almost 90% of water to Euphrates and 10% Syria contributes, but the Tigris River is 40% of almost 40% Turkey, around 40% Iraq, and 10%, 9 to 10% Iran. So those are the water contribution to the system. But country like Iraq, which almost get 90% of its water supply through these two rivers, 90% means Iraq's situation is almost like Egypt dependence on Nile. So I think it's a very important or the critical source of water supply, which is controlled by Turkey.
All right, let's bring in now Arnold Devalet. He's an international lawyer and geopolitical analyst who joins us from Damascus to tell us at least the Syrian side of what's going on. Arnold Devalet, welcome. So Turkish leaders previously to have stated that their country has a right to the water resources that are available in the region running through their country and being sourced from their country. And it actually has made a comparison to how the Arab nations have the right to their oil resources, and therefore Turkey should have that right for its water. Now, does this mean that maybe Turkey is implying or maybe stating indirectly that it wants to exchange water for oil, as it has stated? Previous officials have actually pointed to that. At this point, some are saying that that would mean that water is being used as a weapon.
As far as the Turkish leader guilty of basically implementing those kind of policies as concerns the water and basically what are natural resources belonging to sovereign states. Well, I guess the answer is in the question. I mean, all those resources are part and parcel of sovereign states. And as far as I know, there hasn't been any redrawing of borders. So what we are witnessing is essentially a cynical ploy by the Turkish authorities, obviously for internal political reason, to in thus far as northwest Syria is concerned with the refugees, alleviating the burden on the Turkish economy. As you know, the Turkish economy has not been doing very well. The Turkish lira has been plummeting by 75% the last 18 months. And so this is part and parcel of this kind of, I'm going to go outside my own borders and fix internal problems by exporting it into not only into neighboring states, but also by accaparating natural resources so I can fulfill this project of somehow, and that goes to the heart of the question, expanding, because let's not forget that the ideology of the Turkish government is that of neo-Ottomanism, which bears on reclaiming parts of what used to be the Ottoman Empire.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Countries across the West Asia region are facing a bleak future when it comes to its water resources, brought on by climate change. In this in-depth section, we will look at the destructive effects and whether there are other factors that are exacerbating the situation. Well, when it comes to the West Asia region, it is home, first of all, to 10 out of the 17 countries that are currently facing extremely high water stress, experiencing things like declining rainfall or what's called desertification. The region is also experiencing soaring temperatures. Now, as you're about to see, this is a direct result of climate change, which has gripped many parts of the world, not just unique to this area. Even if global rises are limited to 2 degrees Celsius, average summer temperatures will rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the year 2050. And then we need to take a look at the consequences of these temperatures. Well, they're going to lead to increasing evaporation of things like the surface water, because it's forcing an over-reliance on things like aquifers. Again, this is the section of the ground that's been broken up for us to explain this, and groundwater supplies that are already at risk of over-exploitation. And that is, of course, something that's gripped many countries in the region when it comes to over-exploitation. Now, moving on, let's take a look at some of the stats that we have gathered from, in this case in point, the years 2003 and 2010. And we're going to take a look at the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and the loss. In this case, we're going to take a look at Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran that are along the Tigris and Euphrates river basins. They've lost a lot of water. The figures vary, but they're estimated to be around 144 cubic kilometers of fresh water, of total fresh water that has been lost. And 60% of that loss was attributed to the pumping of groundwater from underground reservoirs. So that's quite a bit of water to have been lost. Next up, Turkey's Southeastern Anatolia Project. That is what it's called. They're really all over the place in terms of what Turkey has done. It's the largest and most controversial dam building program in the world, 22 dams that are either constructed or slated to be constructed along the two rivers and Turkey's borders that are with Syria and Iraq. Now, Turkey's dam and hydropower constructions on the Tigris and Euphrates have been estimated to cut water to Iraq by 80% in terms of Iraq, and then to have cut water to Syria by 40%. These are big numbers. Obviously, some of the consequences, it has jeopardized agriculture and natural habitats. Okay. Now, Syria itself has also been directly impacted by Ankara's dam-building project. Now, in this case in point, we're taking a look at what happened during the year 2006. That was very severe in terms of the drought that came upon Syria. And the devastation it caused for agriculture began from that year. And then, of course, the Turkish dam building contributed more to that. In terms of what it did, it forced large numbers of people into cities like Damascus. And it also has been linked to the social upheaval and unrest that led to the big social unrest of Syria that happened in the year 2011. Okay, now we're going to take a look at water withdrawal. That's the next issue that needs to be tackled in this whole notion of water resources not being available for the region. Let's move on to about water withdrawal in order to understand how Turkey's dam building has affected regional countries. So in terms of that issue, by 2011, Syria's total annual water withdrawal as a percentage of internal renewable water resources had reached 160%. For Iraq, it was 80% and 20% for Turkey. Obviously, these numbers have been are estimates, but they're quite a bit when it when you take a look at the amount, percentage-wise, of water withdrawal that has been done from underground, things like aquifers, for example. Now, on to the next issue, and that's about control that Turkey has over the Tigris and Euphrates. The Euphrates River, Turkey controls 90% of it, Tigris 44%. Obviously, when you have that kind of card stacked for you, then there's a lot that you can do in terms of the control and what you want to get from that. Now, when it comes to control, Turkey holds almost all of the cards on this issue. Take a look at the percentages here when it comes to the Tigris and Euphrates. The Euphrates River, 90% control of the water flows that Turkey has control of, and then the Tigris, 44%, big percentages. Now, what kind of advantages does that give Turkey? Well, unfortunately, this is what Turkey's been accused of. unfortunately for Turkey, that is. It has been accused of manipulating water scarcity, further its political agenda in terms of what it's doing. It's been accused of that. And also, Turkey has been accused of trying to become a regional water superpower. And of course, that brings with it some advantages for Turkey, but how it goes about that and how the countries in the region are going to react to that is what the key question is over here. Let's talk about this a little bit more with our guest, Arnaud Devalier, who's an international lawyer and geopolitical analyst, joins us from Damascus. Arnold, welcome back to Economic Divide. Let's take a look at what we're seeing here, the falling levels of Tigris and Euphrates, which obviously is an impending water crisis for countries like Syria, Iraq, and Iran, which have all accused Turkey of using their dams along the Euphrates and Tigris to hoard the water. Is Turkey guilty of this accusation that's been leveled against it?
Well, I mean, the humanitarian law depriving civilian population from access to food and or water and or basic necessities can be considered a war crime and or crime against humanity. Now, what one needs to understand is that this participates of a strategy that goes back to the Jeffrey doctrine, and which has been reiterated by somebody from the Pentagon who's exclusively tasked with this situation, in at least in thus far as North East Syria is concerned, which is to basically deprive Damascus from all access to oil, wheat, and water, as it turns out. So this is just a part and parcel of the hybrid warfare.
Wow, interesting statement there. Well, let's find out from Ashok Swain, who rejoins us. He's the professor of peace and conflict research at Uppsala University. What he thinks about some of the hoarding that Turkey has done. Ashok Swain, welcome back. Countries across West Asia, obviously, as we've said, they're facing a bleak future in terms of declining rainfall and lack of resources as a result. Climate change, obviously, is part of the reason over here, but also Turkish dam projects. What are your thoughts on that? Doesn't that pose existential challenges for the countries of the region?
It is getting more and more serious. As you know, there have been for the last decade and a half or decade, so at least those internal situation in Syria and Iraq was not good or was not conducive for them to demand or to agriculturally develop or to economically take a sustainable progress because of the internal conflict. But that has changed to some extent, to a large extent. Iraq has stabilized to a greater extent. At the same time, Syria is moving into some kind of peace and certain kind of cessation of hostility, at least. And I think they need demand. They need water. They need water for certain kind of, and also Iran. There is an issue, the demand for the increasing demand for the water for their own agricultural needs, for the drinking water, and all sort of other human resource, human health and development.
When it comes to the issue of dam building by Turkey, it's not just Iraq and Syria that are angered by Turkey's hoarding of water. Iran has faced frequent droughts in recent years, caused in part by climate change as well as dam building in neighboring countries. Tehran has said Turkey's upstream dam building on shared waterways was unacceptable and has called on Turkey to cease such activity. This was in particular in reference to the construction of dams on the Aras River. Tehran has loudly expressed its opposition to Turkey's dam construction on the border water resources, with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs saying such a Turkish move is not acceptable. It's worth taking a look now at the specifics of Turkey's dam building and the dangers that it poses to other regional countries. Over the past 50 years, Turkey's state hydraulic works, known by its Turkish acronym DSI, has been very active. It has built 22 dams and 19 hydropower plants on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. The effect on downstream rivers has left large parts of Syria and Iraq in severe drought. Over the last two decades, the DSI also has been taking up water resources on both the Kura and Aras rivers. Compared to the projects on the Kura, Turkey has built a greater number of dams on the Aras, though with a lower capacity. From 2012 to 2014, Turkey constructed 6 hydropower plants on Aras and is currently planning 8 more. And potentially larger projects are still in the queue. Among these, the recently announced Soylemez Dam particularly stands out, with a planned height of 113 meters and a carrying capacity of 1.4 billion cubic meters. The project would create the 4th largest reservoir in Turkey. Iran's Department of Environment has already warned that Turkey's move to construct Ilisu Dam over Tigris River would pose a serious environmental threat to Iraq and eventually Iran by reducing the entry of Tigris water to Iraqi territory by 56%. Given all the challenges that exist behind Iran's water availability, Iran has not stood still and has aggressively tackled the problem. Iran has gone ahead with a project to desalinate seawater from the Persian Gulf and supply it to the arid areas across the country. The first phase of water transfer from the Persian Gulf to Kerman and Yazd provinces has already been inaugurated. And finally, Turkey's dam-building projects have not only affected regional countries, but also villages and towns inside Turkey, like the 12,000-year-old town of Hasankeyf.
I've seen the new city. I could never love a place like that. I'm from here. These caves are my home. My past is here. My roots are here. It is in these caves that my home resides. For me, luxury is not a house with all the comforts and latest trends. For me, luxury is this.
This ancient southeastern town is now completely submerged underwater. With the construction of the Ilisu Dam and along with it, the heritage and culture of this town, along with memories and the local population. That's the end of this segment.
In conclusion, it is abundantly clear that West Asia is facing water challenges, which poses potentially existential challenges for the countries of the region. That's right, existential. Well, the most critical problem, water security, is affected by the Tigris-Euphrates river system. Now, Turkey is controlling the distribution of this water, and as such, well, it can use it for its own political gains. We've said that. But it is up to regional countries to pressure Turkey diplomatically into working out a viable solution which can benefit all countries involved. That does it for this edition of the program. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for being with us. For Miko Vitahli and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe and 31 meters, 9,835 kHz for Southern Africa and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.